Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is Alison Rudd. Alison, good to have you with us. Are you still basking in the glory of Liverpool?
I've taken my flag down.
Have you? No.
I took it down because I was tired of going out in the street and people stopping me and saying, how long is your flag staying up?
No.
So I decided...
Bar humbug.
I decided a week after being presented with the actual trophy was a good time to say goodbye to the flag.
And what have we done with the flag? Is it neatly wrapped up and
in
pressed?
Silver paper with a nice bow, yeah, absolutely. In a drawer. I actually do have drawers for football stuff.
Do you? What memorabilia stuff?
It's mainly shirts and flags.
Oh, do you have a lot of flags?
I've got thousands of flags.
Have you? Mm. What, all Liverpool or all different types of flags?
No,
this is so intriguing to me.
I have flags of every nation that's competed in a European Championship or World Cup.
And they're
all,
really?
They're all 5 foot by 3 foot.
Oh, now this is fascinating to me. That would make you, would not, am I going to say this wrong, isn't it? A vexillologist or something. Someone that collects flags, I think, or designs flags. Something to do with that. I don't know. I could be wrong.
I vex people. I do vex people, mainly the neighbours. I think that might be what you're looking at. I put out flags when there is a tournament on, and I have strict rules about what flags are allowed to be flown. So, like, for example, the host nation has to be represented. The holders have to be represented. Debutantes have to be represented, and then it's all my favourite countries based on mainly if they have players in them that I've interviewed or I think are particularly elegant players and so on. There's a long list of criteria to make it into the Ali Rudd window display.
I absolutely love this. Gregor, do you have as many flags or do you have one?
I'm feeling very inadequate right now. I think we're going to be talking about what it takes to be a kind of football geek. I think you should have really saved that for that section, Alison. That's very impressive.
that's just an order.
That's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. Wow, that is like above and beyond, isn't it? Gregor, how are you keeping, by the way?
I'm good, yes. How are you, though, more importantly, Nat?
What can I say?
I felt for you. I did feel for you. It was very. Yeah. It's such a heartbreaking. There's nothing like a playoff final in the kind of desolation and joy. There's nothing in between. Mm. It's just.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very tough to take. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm sort of getting over it, but no doubt we're going to have to talk about it, so that'll just bring it all back. But anyhow, there is loads coming up as we talk Arsenal, football finance and football addictions. And we've already had a little insight into Alison Rudd's world. But yes, first we do have to talk about this. Okay, so let's start with the elephant in the room. Fulham 2, Brentford 1 after extra time in the Championship playoff final at Wembley to send Fulham straight back into the Premier League whilst Brentford's brilliant season ends in them coming up just short. Many expected an entertaining game from two of the league's top sides, but the 90 minutes were goalless and perhaps a little cagey with Fulham stifling Brentford's attacking threat. Alison, was that 90 minutes a disappointment or a tactical masterclass for you?
Well, it wasn't a disappointment. And I got quite cross when people were tweeting, whether it was official accounts off of the newspapers or just general fans on Twitter and so on, saying, you know, yawn fest and so on. Mm. I thought it was completely fascinating. When you think what's at stake and that both teams were quite similar in their approach to the game of football. It was never going to be one of those sort of basketball games or a match where two completely conflicting styles get you on the edge of your seat. It was tense, but I think tense makes for good viewing, actually. Mm. And sometimes it was funny how far, like, as the game got closer to the 90 minutes, you could see both teams were just overwhelmingly petrified of being caught on the counter. So they slowed down and then they became less and less adventurous. And I mean, that, you know, you don't, where else can you watch human beings behaving that way? It's the sort of thing you see in a nature program, isn't it? It was entirely logical that you would be fearful of going on the attack and the repercussions from it. So it was, I just found it thoroughly absorbing. I did genuinely think Brentford were disappointing. And that wasn't entirely because you mentioned the word masterclass. I mean, that we'll come on to the specific tactics that were clever, but I think in general terms, I think what happened was that Brentford froze, and Fulham, having been at Wembley quite recently to win a playoff final, just found it slightly less scary than Brentford did. That was what did for the 90 minutes in any case. And then we'll move on to why it was a different story in extra time, I'm sure.
What did you make of that, Gregor?
I have to disagree, Alison. I thought it was pretty turgid stuff, actually, right up until Joe Bryan's goal.
You're supposed to champion Northern League football.
I know. That's a fair point. But the final is really, it's becoming a tradition that it's a bore fest, actually. Yeah. And I think that is absolutely related to the size of the prize on offer. That's grown and grown, and more has been made about it being the most valuable game in football. The quality of the spectacle has declined. Undoubtedly. I mean, I think it probably will never be as bad as the Huddersfield Reading final. That was really probably the worst game I've ever seen in Interside on penalties. And, you know, Alison's right in one regard. Just the kind of seeing the effect that has on players is fascinating. And it's actually more, it would be even more so with the fans there and the kind of simmering atmosphere. I remember that. And, you know, penalty kicks to decide whether you go up or down in that game. Anyway, a moment of brilliance kind of lit the game up, and the final period of extra time was very entertaining. And Fulham deserve great credit, actually, because I think they exceeded a lot of people's expectations. So, yeah, I mean, it was a bit of both. There was certainly, we'll come on to Scott Parker. I can't think of many games in which a manager has burnished his reputation to quite that extent and over one game. I really can't, because if they'd failed, then he would be in the flop who had the best squad on paper, and his future would be in question. So, but he kind of pulled out of the bag and ultimately they were the winners. To say.
Hey, you know, it's been a few days. I've kind of resigned myself to the fact we're not going up. That's not happening. But after a goalless 90 minutes, as we've pointed out, the turning point came in the closing moments of the first half of extra time when Fulham won a free kick 40 yards from goal. The left-back Joe Bryan caught the Bees goalkeeper David Rea off guard, with the Spaniard expecting perhaps a cross and then unable to scamper back and save Bryan's skidding low effort. Do we have any sympathy for David Rea in that moment, Gregor?
Undoubtedly, I'd have sympathy for anyone who made any mistake in a game of such magnitude. But at the same time, I think even just in the kind of specifics of that, it was brilliant. I think anyone in the stadium watching at home, it was the kind of one of the most surprising sort of arresting goals I can remember seeing. It was one where you actually, you know, you had to kind of go, hang on a minute. There was a momentary pause where you were like, has that really gone in? You know, you thought it might have hit the side net. And it was brilliant. Brilliant in its execution and brilliant in its kind of conception as well. So, you know, a huge deal of credit has to go to Fulham and Joe Bryan. But obviously I'd have some sympathy for Rea.
Well, it was obviously clever by Fulham, because that is something that David Rea has done for a long time, coming off his line and coming way off his line, in fact. Joe Bryan revealed, in fact, after the game that his manager, Scott Parker, had told him just moments before the free kick to whip it in the near post because the keeper comes ridiculously far off his line. Is this another indication, Alison, of the attention to detail and that tactical nous that you've both kind of alluded to of Scott Parker?
Well, he did even more than that, Scott Parker, because he'd analysed the goalkeeper aggressive stance and where he would be, and he did tell Joe Bryan, make sure you do whip it in the near post, but he also play-acted that he was telling him to cross it to the far post and therefore completely fool everybody. And the combination of that sort of mind game, but also backed up with good homework and tactical analysis, is almost a rarity, really. And I don't know if it's just because it is at this point, you know, Fulham are still champion, we're still a championship team, and they're just more open about these things. You just don't see. I mean, the last time we had a long discussion about how discussing something and a bit of quick thinking backed up by some analysis was when Liverpool scored that quickly taken corner against Barcelona in the Champions League, and everyone was raving about what Liverpool must have done in the, you know, the backroom staff and so on to analyse. But it was like, that was even more simple than this. This involved some proper, you know, viewing of weeks and weeks of what Brentford did when they set up at set pieces and so on. And to even to go that little extra step further and play act that you're going to just send in a send in a normal cross, I think it's quite funny. And I think it came off. It was staggering. And I'm not pretending it was the world's most exciting match. I just thought it was fascinating as opposed to exciting. Mm. But I think the fact that such a gem of a well thought out goal came when it was getting even more tense, and people were, and no doubt everyone watching was starting to talk about, oh, this is definitely going to penalties, isn't it? And then you're pulled up short by something like that. So yeah, I mean, it's, and Scott Parker said afterwards, you know, it's not just him, it's the team effort that do the analysis and the discussing of what to do. So it's just lovely when something that's, it's like somebody getting an A star in the A level, and they deserve it because they bothered to read the actual text and not the revision notes, isn't it?
Nicely put indeed. But Scott Parker then, how much credit does he deserve, Gregor, for turning what was a relegated side with a losing mentality around? I think even earlier on this season, there were a little bit of doubt, wasn't there, over Scott Parker, I think. There was a brief moment, I think, during the earlier part of the season where things weren't quite going to plan for Fulham. But to have gone from that to now promotion winners through the playoffs, how much credit does he deserve?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, one game, I think, has done his reputation a huge amount. I think, as you know, I said it numerous times on this. A lot of people say Fulham have got the best squad on paper. And he said beforehand in this press conference, you know, I've never seen a piece of paper win you football matches. There's a lot of other things he had to confront in terms of the players' confidence, like an atmosphere around the place. He kind of alluded to the fact that there were some cliques as well. And I think probably if you look back on it, the way that Fulham did so much business in that final kind of flurry of hours and transfer deadline day, and that's got to have kind of disrupted the whole dynamic of the dressing room and stuff. So I think, you know, there's a lot of after effects of that. And as you say, if Fulham have got the best score on paper and everyone agrees with that, and they're not top of the league or even in the top two at any point of the season, that kind of by association means you question the manager's work. And because he's a rookie and he's in his first full season in the job, that I think a lot of people are doing so. Also, you know, there was times where they dominated the ball so much. I think only Leeds had more possession of any club in the Championship. I remember that game against Millwall last August where they had like 934 passes, which was a Championship record, 84% of the ball. They just completely, you know, wiped the floor with them, won 4-0. But then against teams around them, they had quite a poor record, actually. Those added to the sort of question marks as well. So, yeah, and I think something about the way he reacted to the victory too was quite endearing. He was, you know, he's very reserved. He looked so emotional. He's quite a serious and sincere kind of manager in front of the cameras. He's not, for being honest, he's not the best orator, but he showed emotion, and it was quite revealing afterwards about how much he's invested into the job and over the year, and how much relief he felt. So I think, you know, as I say, his reputation was, you know, took a huge stride.
Well, in the Times today, Gary Jacob writes that Fulham are preparing a new deal for Scott Parker that will give him greater control at the club, including transfer business. He had obviously a little spell, didn't he, as manager in the Premier League, but is he ready now to step up, Alison, for you full-time in the Premier League?
I don't know. Because at the
interesting
final
pause.
Whistle, at the final whistle, I was with some Fulham fans and COVIDly safe, I have to add. But I was with some Fulham fans and just for comic effect, I said, "Oh, he'll be sacked at Christmas." But that has been the story of Fulham in recent years. There is this enormous wave of goodwill towards the manager that gets them promotion. They struggle because they're a small club and they will struggle in the Premier League. And then the owner has to decide, do I stick with my man who got me up and all the emotion attached to that, or do I pull the rug from under him and do something more drastic to try and stay up? The owner will want Scott Parker to succeed. I've met Shad Khan quite a lot of times, actually, and there's nothing he wants more than to be able to have a little dynasty going where it's the same manager allowed to build and stamp his design on the team and so on. For the reasons I've just said, if you see someone take a team up, especially, as you say, Gregor, it was so emotional, you can tell that he's really bought into it. I was there when he took over at Fulham and talked about he believed very strongly in the Fulham way, and he wanted the club to be run as a family club with good values, and he wanted them to play good, expansive, attractive, possession-based football. The doubts I have are that it has not been a season of where it's been really clear that when Fulham have lost, that it's been simply because they came up against a team, in a fine run of form, or things went for them that way. The Fulham, often when they've lost drop points, it's because of the manager. It's because Scott Parker has asked them to be cautious, and they've never not don't always judge when's the right moment to go into fourth gear or even fifth gear. There's an element of caution there, and I don't know. So you look at someone like Sheffield United, which everyone will compare them to now. It is possible to come up and thrive. That it's what the outstanding thing about Sheffield United is the clear identity and the belief in it. There's no caution in that team. Even in when they play cautiously, it's done with commitment, if you see what I mean. Whereas Fulham, when they get a bit nervy or doubt that things are going their way, they look weak and they look there for the taking. And that is a reflection of the manager. And I don't know if he's got what it takes to be able to take on the Premier League and think, I can make this team be... when you face Fulham, you know what you're going to get, and you put it on the onus on others to disrupt you because you're going to be strong-willed. I feel they've got wobbles in them, and if they wobble too often, then he won't last for a full season in the Premier League, much as I wish him well.
What do you think then, Gregor? Do you think we can judge Parker, the manager, from this one season in terms of making it to the very top?
I mean, I have no idea about making it to the top. I agree, actually, with Alison in that there are some kind of question marks, like stylistically. It's, as I said, they dominate the ball, but I wrote in my preview for this piece, I think a lot of people at Craven Cottage would probably like to see a little bit more of the kind of pace and purpose that Brentford play with. You know, there's a lot of kind of side-to-side passing and stuff. And, I agree, there is something about... It could be more kind of dynamic, but... I think we are picking it at the very kind of at the edges of this. I think for him to have kind of rebuilt the team's confidence, and they have got a style. It's just it's not always that dynamic. And football, the direction of football is about high pressing and dynamism, high energy. That's the kind of football it is. And this is more, you'd maybe even say something like. Sorry, ball. They have so much of the ball, and they don't always do much with it. That's the kind of thing. So, look, as I say, it's a great achievement, and he absolutely deserves this chance. And I think Fulham are probably better placed this season
Do you?
To go up than they were the season before, yeah.
Do you remember, I spoke to Tim Ream when the things started to go wrong the last time they were in the Premier League. He's such an open and honest and intelligent player, and he said, we're just a wreck in the dressing room. We're not fighting for each other. There's no camaraderie at all. And that is so unusual when a player says, it's just rubbish in there. There's no one prepared
it's
to
very
fight
honest
or anything. You know, we're just not good. And he said they had in the previous season shown an ability to bounce back when things went wrong, and they were not. They'd lost that ability. So when they lost, they just went into a gloomy slump, and then lost again. And there was nobody in the dressing room able to put it all back together. So I would like to go on the record and say Scott Parker's to solve that problem within one season and get Fulham back up when they were at that very low ebb is positive. And therefore I do agree with you, Gregor, that they must therefore be in a better place than they were last time, simply because that camaraderie is back. And, you know, if they've learnt from that and they're cleverer with who they sign, then yeah, I think they could just stay up. I'm just a bit slightly worried about their identity, that's all.
Well, eight of the squad from that fateful year in the Premier League remain, but there has been the addition of 28-year-old centre-back Michael Hector, who has been key this season. And Gregor, I know you've spoken to Fulham's Virgil van Mike for the Times. Could he be the difference for Fulham, do you think, staying up?
He was a huge addition for them. Obviously, he signed last September after transfer deadline day from Chelsea. Just missed the deadline, so he had to train for 4 months, couldn't play. And, you know, Fulham did have a bit of a leaky defence, and when he was introduced, Fulham had 6 clean sheets in the first 10 games. I think their goals per game conceded dropped from like 1.2 to 0.7. So it was just, you know, that he was the only real addition, and it was just that marked, and he was outstanding. I think he was outstanding in the final again, and that, you know, that kind of scoop goal line clearance against Cardiff was something incredible.
Tremendous.
So, you know, Mitrovic's goals, this wouldn't have happened. Hector's addition in January, personally, I don't think this would have happened either. So, and again, going up, you look at them going up, last season they had to rely on, well, they signed Alfie Mawson and he was injured or didn't play a lot of the time. Callum Chambers, he often played in midfield. So they had Adoy and Ream, and undoubtedly Hector is a massive upgrade on both of them.
And the irony is, Gregor, that he came from Chelsea, who really need to sort out their centre-backs. I mean, if I was a Chelsea fan, I'd be thinking, oh, hang on a minute, I quite like Hector back.
You know, he is that good. He'd be in with a chance just now, certainly.
Yeah.
I think he is outstanding, and he's had a remarkable journey as well. At 28 to be hitting the Premier League, I think he had 15 loan clubs. He's played in 10 different leagues, including Scotland, Ireland, Germany, all three football league divisions, non-league football. It's been a remarkable journey for him, so great for him to get a chance finally at the Premier League too.
So it is Fulham who are going up then, but disappointment for Brentford, who'll have to go again next season in the Championship. We have seen Leeds bounce back from playoff heartbreak to finish top of the pile, but one problem for Brentford could be being able to keep hold of their star players. Brentford's BMW front three have caught the eye, but the club will have a tough job to keep hold of Syed Benrahma by the looks of things. And after 17 goals this season, there's reported interest from the likes of Leeds, Villa and even Spurs could see them lose the 24-year-old Algerian. Alison, do you think Brentford are resigned to losing some of their players? Come on now, kick me when I'm down.
No, but it's not a question of resignation. It's a question of this is their model, and they will happily sell their key players as long as they get good money for them. That's what Brentford do. And if you're a Brentford fan, which you are, you know that's true. You're going to lose them as long as the money's there.
Yes.
But if the scouts were only watching the final, then you'll be all right, because no one was signed.
We'll be all right, won't we?
Benrahma,
we'll be safe
after watching.
We'll be
that.
Fine.
But he, I have seen him live play utterly fantastic football, where he just twirls and swirls and nutmegs and dazzles defenders, and you've got to think, really, how would he be in a team where, with all due respect, they were able to get more of the ball to him, and he, you know, there's players of his quality to play off, so to speak, because sometimes it's a bit of a solo run, isn't it, when he's there. I mean, I'm scared of annoying you, Natalie. But when Brentford click, it's because he plays well, and those sorts of players, they are, you know, they're coveted. And I'm sure he would like to know what it would be like to play for an established or a reasonably established Premier League team. But if he does go, don't worry, because it will be for the right money, and they will have planned for it. It will not come as a shock to anyone at the club when they sell him. It will be planned for, and they will have replacements lined up.
I mentioned those teams that are interested, reportedly Leeds, Villa and Spurs. I think Chelsea as well have been mooted. Can you see him playing at any of those, Alison? Any of those teams fitting in?
I could see him at Spurs. They've not, other than Son, there's no one that gets you off your seat, really, at Spurs in that way, I don't think. But whether he's a Mourinho player or not is another question. But because I don't think he does. I don't know. I've seen him track back. I've seen him put him tackle.
No,
he's not.
Yes.
It's not what he's famous for. But I mean, he'd probably. I don't know. You never do know, do you? Whether it would click going to a bigger club and it clicks and he himself just becomes that bit better, or whether he's sort of just treated because of where. His journey, that he's treated as a super sub or something. I mean, it's a big step to sign someone from Brentford and then build your team around him. Mm, but I do feel when he's playing well, he definitely could fit in to a top half of the table club, because he's just got that thing that is rare, that sort of innate ability to see where the space is and drag the ball along into it. It's when he's working well, it's absolute joy to watch.
Mm. Oh, it certainly is, and we've certainly enjoyed him. But I know that we are all resigned to losing him, and perhaps one or two more. Gregor, when you consider that there will be changes at Brentford, but as Alison points out, normally Brentford's analysts and scouts and everyone, they always find a suitable replacement, if not better, sometimes. If they are able to do that, replace those that leave, could Brentford be favourites for automatic promotion next season? Give me some hope.
I don't think Brentford will ever be favourites for the Championship, personally. No. I think it's purely because their clubs will come down, even if they are fairly kind of diminutive clubs this year, in Bournemouth and Watford, Norwich. You know, they've all got their own issues, but they've got the parachute payments, and Bournemouth are probably going to gather, you know, they could gather £100 million or something worth of, if they sell some of the players this summer. So I don't think they'll be favourites, but you know better than us. Brentford are kind of renowned for regenerating, even when they lose their best players, and it's part of their plan. It's how they A, break even, and now B, invest more in the team, and their horizons have been broadened a bit. They can pay more for the players that they sign, and they'll get more for them in return when they sell them. So they'll be up there, I'm sure. And it's a wide open league. If you look at it now, I don't see a favourite. The way Nottingham Forest ended last year, I really can't pick a team that's favourite. I would probably say Watford, because they all seem to get their act together. But no, it's going to be wide open, and I'm sure Brentford will be in amongst it.
Hooray! Some big news now coming out of Arsenal this week. They've become the first Premier League club to announce major job losses after the coronavirus pandemic. They claim they needed to make 55 redundancies to continue investing in the first team. The cull, which a club source said will save many millions of pounds, will predominantly affect those working in hospitality, events, commercial and administrative positions. The club's scouting network, already trimmed back at a previous round of cuts, will also take a further hit. The news comes as the Gunners close in on a three-year, £100,000 a week deal to bring Willian from Chelsea to North London, as well as continued negotiations over a new £300,000 a week contract for Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. As you can imagine, it's left a bad taste with many fans, including club legend Ian Wright, who took to Twitter to vent his frustration. Wright tweeted, "Remember who you are, what you are, and who you represent," alongside three disappointed face emojis. Alison, like Ian Wright, are you just as disappointed with Arsenal?
Probably not. I'm not as emotionally invested. I think this is... We're forgetting that football is a business, and just because football is also about passion and love and hate and is often the centre of a lot of people's universe and is all they care about, it is actually a business at the end of it. And what Arsenal have done is work out that the hospitality and corporate side of their business has taken a massive hit. I mean, it would do, wouldn't it? There's no one there to buy very expensive gin and tonics and whatever else they give them. So they're thinking, well, we have to restructure, we have to make redundancies, which is exactly what would happen in any other business that was reliant on hospitality. But then you throw in the fact that Arsenal players took their own wage cut because they were told, you're going to save the jobs of other people in the Arsenal family. So you think, oh, well, actually, what's going on here? Because that's quite a rare thing for... Because they're two separate businesses. There's the players you buy and that play and gain the revenue from TV. And then there's all the stuff around the edges where you which we'll just call corporate hospitality for the sake of calling it something else. And there was effectively subsidising that. And well, now they're being told that wasn't enough. I can't believe a 12.5% wage reduction doesn't give you quite a lot of revenue to do the subsidy. So I'm less cross with Arsenal for making redundancies, because that's what happens in bad times. It's not nice, but it's not like they're the only business in the world to be struggling at the moment and to do that. It's because they appeared to be on top of it. They appeared to have players that were buying into the football's a family and not just a business, and we want all the people connected to the club to have their jobs saved. And that's sort of, it just seems to have fizzled out. That seemed to be a really lovely model, even if it seemed slightly naive model and not one that would happen in normal business. There seemed to be the sense that, well, maybe football is different and maybe people do find it obscene that players are paid so much per week when you compare them to other people in the same organisation who just get a sort of normal type of salary. But there they are prepared to say, no, we'll take a pay cut if we save jobs. So did they add up wrong, or did they... Oh, I don't see why Arsenal are suffering more than other clubs that rely heavily on other match day income, to the point that those other clubs didn't get the players to take the pay cut, but they're not. Maybe this is the beginning, Natalie. Maybe now every club will think, oh well, they're the ones that have taken the PR hit. We'll do the same thing. We'll just lay people off who normally work behind the bar on match day or whatever it is. So what annoys me isn't that people make redundancies because we're living in difficult business times. What annoys me is where's their modelling gone wrong? It looked like they'd been able to find a plan of action to keep everyone together, and it just seems surprisingly fast to have decided they need to axe staff.
Well, should we crunch some of the numbers? You mentioned you were asking a few questions there, Alison. Well, Arsenal were, as you pointed out, the only Premier League club to agree a player wage cut during lockdown, which will be 7.5% after qualifying for the Europa League. So that's, in theory, saving the club £18 million. The amount saved by the 55 job losses is expected to be a fraction of this, as at an average salary of £35,000 a week for a player will save just under £2 million from their wage bill, which was £232 million last season. However, Arsenal have an unusually large number of staff, 724 in total, of which only 73 are players. Gregor, I know we've sort of talked about this already, in particular more focusing on the EFL and the fear that we could even lose some clubs as a result of what's been happening of late. Do you think this is just the start of difficult job cuts across football and other industries in the wake of COVID-19?
I mean, it's very likely, yes. And look, I know when you know when you juxtapose the players earning millions and millions of pounds and them offering contracts, as a lot of people are doing just now, and they're offering big contracts to players at the same time as laying off 55 people. You know, it's quite kind of striking and difficult to swallow. But Alison's right. If these jobs don't exist anymore, some of them. I mean, if you were going to have a conference at the Emirates, or you know, there was some event, you either can't do it anymore, or you have to do it in a very different way. So I don't, and we, really, that's kind of looking like it's going to be the case for the foreseeable. So there is something, you know, it's admirable, and it's right that clubs try to do what they can to keep as many staff as possible, but it's going to be impossible because some of these jobs won't really exist anymore. There'll be nothing, you know. I don't want to say there'll be nothing for them to do, but it's going to be very different. That's one part. But the other side, they've got to look at it. And some of this is Arsenal's scouting department, and people have been raising questions about whether Kia Jorbachin, the agent, is kind of taking quite a lot of power in terms of Arsenal's recruitment. Willian, I think, is his latest client, who looks like he might be signing. So, you know, there is that, and a lot of, you know, Arsenal already trimmed their scouting network down quite heavily earlier this year, I think it was. And it seems some of these people are scouts as well, so long-term scouts. So that's interesting too. That could be a different dynamic to that. I don't, you know, it's going to be hard to know until we see more of Arsenal, how they're planning on restructuring that side of the business. But when we're talking about things that are actually a business, it's almost like, you know, they're associated with football. Those things are things that drive revenue to pay the players on the pitch, and it's not happening anymore. So that's the dynamic of football, and it's very sad for these people, but I think probably it is the start.
I suppose, Alison, on paper, when you look at the money that is being discussed about players coming in, players who are already at the club whose contracts are being renegotiated, and also players who are possibly sat on the bench or not even in the squad, you can understand why there is some disappointment. But equally, at the end of the day, isn't this all about Arsenal protecting their biggest assets, which are the players and the football team itself?
Yeah, you've got a point. They have to ring fence the football from the other elements of their business that are suffering because of the pandemic. Also, I think it may be that the current problems have made them think, wow, as you put it, Natalie, they do have an unusually large number of staff. Why is that? Why do Arsenal have more staff than most other clubs? So it could be that streamlining now, rather than taking the romantic view and being scared to be talking about signing players on big wages at the same time as letting staff go, if they're prepared to take that PR hit, in the long term, more jobs will be saved. Because it's not sustainable to have a lot of people working on the sector of your business that isn't functioning properly. The football is functioning properly. Football, they're in Europe. They have a Premier League campaign to navigate. They want to be back in the Champions League. They want to be fighting for the title. They have a trajectory they want to follow, and they're not going to be able to do that if they think they are morally obligated to not spend if they're having to lay off staff. And as I made the point earlier, is the issue of cross subsidy, which I think is a separate issue. And if they're not prepared to go the whole hog with that, then in a strict business sense, then yeah, it is right that they do put a ring around both sectors of their business, and as you put it, not just protect the players but protect the other staff. If you're tough now, you could be in a healthier financial state 2 or 3 years down the line, I think.
Now, we're going to finish today's podcast by talking about one of the game's great characters, and that is Neil Warnock. Warnock is 72 in December. When he took over at Crystal Palace in 2007, he said it would be his last job. He helped keep Middlesbrough in the Championship at the end of last season during an 8-game temporary spell. There is a 2-year contract now for him and still an insatiable desire to succeed in what is his 16th role as manager in an extraordinary career. In his latest press conference, he's been speaking about what keeps him motivated. He said this, "Is management my addiction? I think so, yeah," he says, "although I do enjoy a nice whiskey. When I look around, I just feel good around people that I know I can get something out of. It's not just the players. Jobs are so difficult. You have to have humour. You have to enjoy it. I love making players better. I make bad players average, average players good, and good players great." So Neil Warnock is addicted to football. Can we understand what he means, Gregor?
I think so. I mean, given that... I too have spent my entire working life around it in some capacity. I think I would definitely say I'm addicted. But I've had a kind of, I don't know, slightly different relationship. And when I played, I wasn't actually someone who would watch football religiously. Maybe I should have. I might have learned one or two things. But I think there can be a limit, personally. But I am undoubtedly addicted and there's plenty of evidence of that throughout my life.
Go on, tell us then. What's the evidence?
Well, I think, I don't know, I remember moving down here, moving down to London a couple of years ago, and it was kind of like the summer that was hotter than the sun, and spending every waking minute for about 2 weeks in a darkened room with a fan on, just watching every game in the World Cup in Russia. And... I think actually asking my girlfriend earlier about this, it took her about a split second to say that I'm a kind of a football geek pretty much every single day, and that I watch a game on TV, another on the iPad, and scroll through Twitter all at the same time. Sometimes I tell her stories about sort of nondescript, non-league teams with such enthusiasm, like completely unaware that she really doesn't care at all. And at that point, she was kind of really getting into her flow, so I left the room. So she's, so certainly, Susie would say I'm addicted to football.
Alison, are you the same? Are you as addicted?
Well, isn't addiction a negative word? I don't.
Oh, it can be, I suppose.
I think I resent the phrase addiction.
All right, you're a football fan. Should we say that?
Yeah, I am, and I don't. I mean. I've been doing this job 25 years, and in that time I have met quite a few people who have admitted to me, I've been sat next to them in the press box, and they've said, I'm not enjoying this anymore, I'm gonna do something else, or I think I'm getting a bit jaded. And so when I first started and people were telling me that, I was thinking, oh my word, I wonder how many years I've got before I feel, you know, this is just run-of-the-mill stuff. I'm not excited. But I will admit that I get excited when the Times football desk put out the match list so you find out where you're going for the next two games. I open that email like it's opening a big, big surprise package in the post. I think, oh, where am I going to go? Where am I going to go? I'm sad enough to sometimes think, I'll guess where I'm going. And I still have that sort of childlike sort of enjoyment of the mere act of being sent to watch a football match. And it hasn't happened to me yet that I feel jaded. So if that means I'm addicted, then so be it. But I wouldn't call that addiction. I would just call that being in love with something and being devoted.
Perhaps that's a better way of saying it, in love with football. But just before we move on and talking about your own personal experiences, for you, Gregor, obviously having played the game, did you ever think about not being a part of the game still? Obviously you've moved into a different element of football in terms of being a journalist now, but did you ever think you could move away from it altogether?
Yeah, I did. Actually, I think you'll find that a lot of players they go on a bit of a journey. I think when they're kind of in their early to mid-20s, you ask them if they're going to be a coach or whatever, a lot I will say no chance. You know, I think I'll go and try something else, or I'll, you know, I think it just feels like that the day you end is quite distant, and it's an achievement to reach in itself. So kind of envisaging staying in the game beyond that is quite hard to do. So, and then when you get towards your 30s, you're not really sure what else you can do. And a lot of people then start doing their coaching badges and stuff. And I did that, and I enjoyed it to an extent, but I think I wanted to do something that was different but still associated to football, and I'm glad to have been able to do that. But it does give you a wee bit of a different relationship with the game, I think, because you're a fan first, then you become a player, and then you kind of, I don't know, what am I now? I'm a fan, but it's still my job. So, but yes, always, I'm sure I'll always have some connection to football.
In terms of Neil Warnock, then, he keeps on going, and who knows when he'll finally decide that he's had enough. But when we reflect on his career so far, Alison, how do you think he'd be best remembered when he finally calls it a day, which probably won't be for decades, knowing the way that Neil Warnock's going?
Well, he's entertaining. I haven't had too much to do with him, actually, weirdly. Not been at many of his press conferences, but a few. I was there when it was April 2018, and it was the end of the season, and he was manager of Cardiff, and Wolves were about to win the title, the championship title, and Cardiff, I think they missed two penalties at the end, and when the final whistle went, Nuno Espirito Santo, he ran onto the, he said shaking hands, you remember this, he ran onto the pitch to celebrate with his goalkeeper.
Yes, I do remember this.
It was John Ruddy, and well, I mean, I do forgive Nuno for that, because it was, I mean, it's a bit odd, isn't it, to win a game that way, and it's quite nice to see Nuno get a bit emotional. But Warnock went absolutely, he just started swearing like crazy, and it was live TV, and he was so angry. But then he it was like, I sort of feel with him, he's quite calculated in it. So quite a lot of minutes pass, and then he comes into the press room, and he starts slagging Nuno off for having no etiquette, no manners, no class. He's a disgrace. Even though Nuno had tried to subsequently shake his hand, I'm not going to do that now, sort of thing. And it was left to me when Nuno came in. I'll always remember this. Because I was thinking, oh, surely the people who follow Wolves all the time will ask him about this. This was the big story of it was the big story of the night, and people were just not talking about it. So I said, oh, Nuno, did you realise you've just been accused of having no etiquette, manners or class? The look I got, he said, oh, I'm used to elite football. I know exactly what etiquette, manners and class are. So that's probably my, that sort of indignation from Warnock, who, it felt like it just suited him at the time to deflect from how his players were probably feeling terrible. And so he just, I mean, good managers do that, don't they? They take the spotlight so the players don't have to worry about the mistakes they made on the pitch. So I suppose he's an old school deflector like that, and he likes the limelight, and really doesn't mind how often he swears, because he knows we'll just bleep it out for him. And I think he likes being considered a character. Mm-hmm. And I dare say it defines him, and that's what he means by addicted, is that's who he is. And if he's not in charge of a football team, then who is he? So I suppose, I just think. And he thinks he deals with the media well. I think he plays the media quite well. I've seen him be a bit grumpy when he isn't being, you know, that he hasn't got a rapport going, and he feels like it's running away from him slightly, then he'll become quite sort of spiky. But, I hope I've nothing against him. I hope he carries on till he's 91 indeed. I hope so. That'd be great.
I think we'd like one of those, a long-term manager like that. It would be great fun. Well, do you know what? It kind of got us thinking. When he was asked the question of addicted to football, he said yes. And the internet, as we love it, is full of articles on signs you may be a football nerd. So I'm going to ask both of you to answer these to see whether or not you are guilty of it. Attending more than one game a day. Greg, have you done that?
I think I probably have. maybe like a non-league game, and then kind of a game in more in a higher level afterwards. Or I've definitely played in games, and then gone to watch another game. So yes, I think technically okay. yes, but that not tick. Like with great regularity.
No, Alison, have you done that?
No. I mean, I've attended kids' games and then gone on to a real game. I don't think that counts, does it? So I've managed to have a whole day of football.
Well,
so
I think
I've either been refereeing or coaching or watching my kids play football. Then I've dashed to a game. Then I've come home and watched the late kickoff. Maybe managed to squeeze in a bit of the earlier game too. So well, I don't know. You can tell me whether that counts.
I think that would be, because some people might think, well, if I'm having to attend a game, say for work purposes, I don't need to do anything before that. I need to relax and not worry about any other football. But you haven't. You've decided to fill your whole day with football. So
but
I think
that's the perfect day. That's the perfect
absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely. No, I'm with you. But I think that is a tick in the box, shall we say.
Okay.
That's a tick in the box. What about ever having to set your alarm and be woken up in the middle of the night to watch a game? Has that happened, Gregor?
I don't think so. I can remember.
No.
Not that
I'm trying
remember,
to think
no.
of the kickoff for Japan. What was yeah. that? Maybe that. I don't know. I can't even remember.
Scotland
that's
weren't
so
in
long
it,
ago.
So I probably didn't bother.
No, Alison, would you have done that?
I stayed up really late, but I don't think I've gone to sleep then woken up again. No.
No. All right. Yeah, it's not like one of those pay-per-view boxing bouts that people do that for in America. But anyway, all right, so that's a cross for that. How about going into the club shop and pretty much buying everything there is? Alison?
No, but I do buy stuff, but it's quite selective. I don't...
Well, it's flags, as we know.
I don't buy flags. If I go to cover a match abroad, I like to bring back something. So usually a mug, if it's a particularly attractive design from the club shop. So... Or a shirt for my son. Or yeah, I have spent quite a lot of time in club shops actually. I look carefully for the right thing.
Okay, yeah, that's good. I like that. I probably would do the same. You got to find the nicest thing in the shop that isn't tacky, shall we say?
Yes.
Gregor, what about you?
Well, when I first started doing the journeyman column, I used to have to, there was a kind of panel down the side, and one of the regular things was the weirdest thing in the club shop of whatever club I visited.
Oh, I like
and,
it.
And I remember what I found the kind of weirdest in the first week, I think it was at Burton Albion or someone, there was like Burton Albion car mats. Like, but then when you start going to, you know, I went for a few months, you realise that most club shops have got pretty much all the same stuff. So it was getting harder and harder to find the weirdest thing. But yeah, the car mats, I think that was a big surprise. But me personally, not really, no, I'm afraid.
No. I have to say, we do own a few Brentford gnomes. There's a few of those knocking about. I have to say, yeah, they've definitely been bagged a few times. What about revising football trivia so you don't get caught out in pub quizzes? I think this is a silly one, really, because, Alison, you don't need to revise football trivia. You just know it.
I used to be. I'm really bad now. I think Google has been bad for my brain. Because
I'm not surprised.
If you're at a game... I don't need to watch a game knowing everyone's stats because I can just quickly look them up. So I don't, it's like a waste of brain space to fill it with stats. But before Google, when I was a kid, some of my happiest moments were when at the end of term and the teachers would say, okay, we're going to have a quiz, and people would pick teams, and you know, you wouldn't want a girl on your team if it was going to be a sports quiz. We'd always win because I was the girl who knew I knew the sporty stuff. But
that's
because you had to know it. You couldn't look it up. You either knew it or you didn't know it. So I don't revise now. No.
What about you, Gregor? Ever had to do that?
Actually, probably for the first time ever, during lockdown when I was having the odd Zoom quiz. I was doing a bit of revision then, if I was doing ones with my mates. But
you took
lost.
It that seriously?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Competitive. I still lost
it. Oh, dear. Taking time off work to watch football, has that ever happened to you, Alison?
Football's my work.
No, yeah, this one doesn't work for us.
I know.
It?
Well, I don't know. Maybe you've just thought, I don't want to work today. I want to actually just enjoy it rather than work.
No, I would, if I had a day off or a week off and there was football on, I would watch the football. So there you go.
There you go. And Gregor, I suppose that's the same for you.
Yeah, yeah. I've not really... I've never really had a job I can take time off either, to be honest.
No, that's true. It's a bit tricky for you to say to the...
Yeah, go on.
I know. Chris Wilder, do you mind if I have next week off? It's a really important game.
I fancy going to the Old Firm.
And what about this one then? Have you prefer to watch, or do you prefer to watch football at home than in a pub to concentrate on it properly, Gregor?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, or worse, I go and I'm the most antisocial friend imaginable. So,
oh dear, nobody wants that.
No. Yeah, no, definitely. I want to, because you can't watch it properly. You can't hear the sort of analysis and the half-time debrief and all that stuff. Definitely much prefer watching at home.
But would you do that? What if it was just a social gathering in the pub? Do you still, would you still rather be able to hear the analysis, even if it's a day off, you're not working, Gregor?
Or if it's a big game, absolutely, I will zone out and I will ignore my friends and try and listen to us and understand what's going on in the game.
Wow, we are really learning about the true Gregor Robertson now. Alison, would you agree though with what?
Yeah, Gregor? overall, I'd rather watch football so I can really concentrate. But occasionally, it's nice to be in a pub and to get showered by beer when a goal is scored. I want to go through that.
That's true. Okay, confession time then. What is your biggest football geek moment? I don't really like to say football geek because it's a passion, isn't it? So, Alison, we've learnt about your flags and the fact that you are a vexillologist. There we go. Gregor, have you got anything that you want to divulge now? You want to own up and confess to?
I don't think I could really call it a geek. I could call it kind of fanboy moment I had once had, where I think I probably said on this podcast my absolute hero growing up was John Collins, classy left-footed player who played for Celtic. Posters all over my bedroom wall, and it happened that when I was 18 at Forest, I played against Fulham in a reserve game, and John Collins was playing. And afterwards, I couldn't resist going up and telling him how much he was my hero. Like, it was, I think I went far too far into full fanboy mode, and it was getting a little bit awkward. He was very kind to me, actually, and he's kind of in the way he reacted. But that's probably my biggest fanboy geekish moment, I think.
And Alison, I'm assuming the collection of flags isn't what you would regard as your biggest footballing geek moment, is it? Or is it?
No, I hadn't even thought of that. when Eddie Large died earlier this year, someone sent me a clip and I'd completely forgotten, but I had appeared on Badil and Skinner's fantasy football show. Yeah. And I was there representing a team. My team, a league called the Elvis Presley Memorial League, and my team was called Barca Babes. And in the clip, they go, "Oh, I think we've got a manager in the audience, and it's Alison Rudd." And I look so ridiculous. Anyway, I'm wearing a Barca jacket, and they actually said, "Why is your team called Barca Babes?" And I said, "Well, I like Barca. I'm a babe, and I didn't expect to have to justify it in front of tens of viewers." And they cut that bit.
And then
they asked me about my team, and this is where it gets geeky. So on telly, there's me, and I start moaning about the fact that in my fantasy team, I've had to put Teddy Sheringham in, and I shouldn't have done. And it's just so train spottery. It's just so I thought probably given how public it was. And there's still footage out there, and quite a lot of people tweeted when it came out. People were tweeting me, "Oh, you were so cute." But anyway,
so you went from fantasy football to collecting flags. Is that what happened, or were you already collecting flags at that point?
No, I was already collecting
flags. Really? Is there one flag that's more precious than any of them all?
Yeah, because on Mother's Day, I got a card that said "Happy Panama's Day," and it was the Panama flag. Isn't that lovely?
Oh, that is sweet. That is sweet. I love it. Who knew? Did you know this, Gregor? This obsession with flags that Alison
had? Absolutely not. No, I'm intrigued. Have you got like a kind of big casket at home that you keep them all in, or what?
Yes, I've got. I've got an old-fashioned filing cabinet.
Oh.
So if you were a thief, then you might think, you'd open it up and it's full of flags. It's not full of important documents.
Are they alphabeticalised?
Oh, no, because the fun is, before every tournament, you have to throw them all over the floor and try and remember who's who and then make decisions, and we have votes and things. It's good.
I just love it. I absolutely love it. Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to Alison and to Gregor. Remember to subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times for award-winning journalism on every platform. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. All you have to do is search The Times subscription for more information. We will be back with you on Monday. So in the meantime, enjoy your weekend.